Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Well, if we really do think like an ecosystem, and you think that in nature, in wider nature, of course, we are nature, everything is created by the context in which it is in and shaped. You know, a plant thrives or not depending on what situation it's in, what is the soil like, does it have access to the sunlight, etc. And so everything is shaped by everything around it. And that's what I mean when by saying the only choice we don't have is whether to change the world.
That's the voice of Frances Moore LePay. On this week's show, we speak to Frances about her award-winning book, Getting a Grip, right after a song by Nomadic Massive, so stay tuned.
Pasa mo estilo, yo con el chapo un pollo Poco, meneño lang to ku pinocchio Salud, le yo pa con equis aquí rasu Me maluk, mande sac con el muestro na ma buk Mala je coti mal, para lo tro banal Su coti ne con sa wapini no go escanal Fosis con pa de mal, me pa vi po mal Me pa fosse en calo, voy a tetro a mon canal
C'est dans les annales, style conviction et artisanal Know the range in us, this do a got tank dangerous So strange and such, two brains that rush Pain with the brush that stain with the pain of a razor's rust Cunning, we cunning Border crossing, running, stunning with the hunting of words, punning, coming at ya. Got you out your zone. New piece, all boot, tight like catacombs. Like stepping to the mic with no skills. Like ripping up a 6 month over the bill.
Looking at watching moon call. Parabagas
and kids won't listen to their parents. Lost in a video game with music blaring. Like spending an hour flipping channel, you're watching commercials at prices you can't handle.
Danger, rush is so dangerous. I look around, all I see is danger. Danger surrounding me,
Like they trash that, wars for cashback, it's sad that my man Nars can't spend his summers in Baghdad. Why is that? The reasons are clear, but the truth is never out there. It might get dangerous if you speak loud and clear. Lots of fear, got people nervous, sticking to their own. But we ain't got no home, that's why we prone. To these hip hop rhythm, live them out with our own twist. Lemon and curvy in a hurry, but there's a long list of people waiting to get something out of life. Running out of time with a gigantic appetite. Obese expectations, that's why we train our hearts. Never blindfolded if we have to throw a dart. These minds, hearts defined like Untouched vinyl, centralized, connect dots like rule lino. Yeah, live out this moment, pull out your tape recorder. You never know at every corner, there might be some sort of Like George Bush's vision of the planet, like missiles crossing the Atlantic, I see you panic. When neighbors won't greet each other, people don't know how to treat each other. But here we the When religion means division, cutting up people with the precision of a surgeon's incision.
Dangerous is so dangerous. If I look around, all I see is danger surrounding me. J'avance dans sa cadence, non balance, pas d'avance. Pour tout ton café, mi gade, espoir, gagne délivrance. Si m'prends micro, c'est pour m'chanter, revendiquer, pour m'cadoucher, sac bague, voir, baillot, l'espoir, casser la croix, pour l'bon pouvoir. Son ange pour propre vie, ou tout va qu'on en tête, ou les décampés et prend place, ou ma boue, ou pipi sans passer pour nous. Depuis l'an, si tu font libérer l'esprit en nous. Prendre tes focus, pas prendre un blocus. On apprend à marcher, même si t'es stagé à cactus. En grand, pas j'en bêtise, y'a qu'un grand mot. M'va faire autre chose, parce que moi, c'est y'en est trahiment. Borok, pas j'en bec croisé en gain choc. Qui démêlé ma voix sous son rappel qui saute New York. No lock, pas j'en prends chance pour gratter stem. Si t'en joues ta bouche, t'en m'en prends au moins tout ça.
that was the incredible Nomadic Massive, Danger, Danger. It seems for too long the media has been trying to inculcate this fear of one another, fear of your neighbor. You know, there's always something we're supposed to be afraid of. Well, someone who is not afraid of anything, her book inspires a certain confidence and courage, is Frances Moore Lapace. She's a best-selling author. She's written many books. Her latest book, Getting a Grip, it's a wonderful book about resistance. It's a book that has sold now more than 3 million copies, and people really are inspired by her. So we're very privileged to have her on our show. Thank you so much for joining us, Frances.
I'm delighted. Totally delighted.
Now, I was thinking about the way in which our society at times can tend to feel a bit frightful. If the only source of your news or information is the media, then, you know, you might as well put your head under the bed and don't get out, because things look pretty sad. So let's begin there. Let's talk a little bit. In your book, you say, why are we as society creating a world that we as individuals abhor? And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, first of all, how we've created this monster that we seem to be afraid to live in.
Right. It kind of defies logic in a way, doesn't it, that we created something that none of us individually would ever choose. So how did that happen? And my theory, and I stress theory because I really want to be engaged with other people with differing ideas, but what I've come to is that the only thing powerful enough to cause this to happen is the power of ideas. That sounds kind of strange, but actually in our species, it turns out that our minds are more powerful than instinct, that our minds can actually override instincts. When you think of, you know, people do on the positive side, people denying themselves food, an instinct, in a hunger strike for an idea, some idea of justice. And on the other hand, on the negative, you read and hear the horror stories of parents killing their children in honor killings. Nothing could be more against our evolution than killing our own offspring, right? And yet an idea of honor seems to make that happen. So I'm arguing in Getting a Grip that actually what we have to look at are the ideas that rob us of power, that rob us of power to create the world we really want. And the core idea that you touched on as you began, you know, you talked about fear. At the base of that fear is the assumption of scarcity, of lack, that there's just not enough goods and there's not enough goodness in us.
In your book, you talk about a different kind of democracy than the one we have been inculcated with, you know, this representative democracy that doesn't seem to serve our interests. Because as Susan George points out, we elect our government, but then they give the money to the bank. So, you know, they're not really acting in our interests. But in your book, you're very lucid about the kinds of democracy. You call it a thin democracy and a participatory democracy. Can you tell us the difference?
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, the term I like best is living democracy, because that term living democracy, it kind of brings up for me associations of ongoing change and something that has that is an organism, like an ecological system. And so I describe what we have now as thin, or actually what I've come to is calling it a privately held government. It's not really a democracy in the sense of answering to the citizens. So representative democracy wouldn't be bad at all if we could get there, you know, electing people really accountable to us. And what I underscore toward the end of Getting a Grip is that there is a pathway there of to get money out of the system. But I contrast this notion of thin democracy or privately held government, which is something done to us or for us, a structure of government that we kind of inherited and is failing us. I contrast that with what is emerging that so gets me up in the morning, which is this idea, back again to the power of ideas, that democracy is really a culture, that you can have all the institutions in place, and if you don't have the culture of participation and the values of engaging with others in direct problem solving, then you can't solve your problems. It came to me when I first started working on the question of world hunger, and I traveled to places like, you know, the Philippines or Central America, and they had India, you know, they have elections, and they had multiple parties, but people, majority were living in misery, so those institutions don't themselves define democracy. It's the culture that we create, and right now I think we're unfortunately going away from a culture of democracy based in the values of inclusion of all of us, of mutual accountability, and the ongoing dispersion of power.
As you're talking about the kind of cultural democracy we need to create, you actually spell it out in your book, and you call it an ecology of democracy, and you actually spell out the five different particular qualities. Now, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that ecology of democracy, because I think this is essential to understanding what it is we're lacking and where it is we want to get to.
This is essential, you know, the idea of democracy as something that just sort of set in place and finished a structure, that is failing. And so I describe an ecology of democracy is not a set system, but a set of system qualities. And, for example, one of these five is simply the notion, the quality that it is ever-changing and evolving, that it's not fixed. I argue that the only choice we don't have is whether to change the world, because, in fact, we're changing the world moment to moment for the good or the bad, even if we don't act, you know, that we're still having an effect. Another argument that I make is that living democracy is an aspect of these values that I mentioned of inclusion and fairness and mutual accountability. They're equally valid in economic life, in education, for example. We see great progress where students are empowered to be part of decision-making. That these values aren't strictly political sphere values, that in a living democracy, you know, that they really work. As I say, they're not strictly political values. So those are the kinds of things that I pull out in this book.
One of the most important things you mention in your book is that democracy is not something we're born with, that we're not learned, or that is automatic, you know, something that we sort of pass on genetically, but rather that is something we culture, we nurture, we teach, and we foster as a relationship. And the opposite of that is what you represent in your book, and you point out, you even have a draft for it that you call the spiral of powerlessness. So I want to spend a little time talking a little bit about how sometimes we disempower ourselves and the different steps that take us there, and then the opposite of that, which you also offer. So let's talk a little bit about when we're lacking this element of dynamism in democracy, of participation, of values, of you know, how do we create this spiral of powerlessness that you describe in your book?
I'm so glad you touched on this. It's actually sort of the third quality of living democracy, that it is a learned art, you know, just like we learn to play the piano or to write. You know, we can learn the arts of democracy using power creatively, using conflict creatively, mentoring others, negotiating difference, mediating, all of these things that young people are learning in certain contexts. I have a little chapter, you know, on rethinking power, because a lot of people, power is a dirty word. You know, you think that anybody who has power, it has to mean control and manipulation, when actually power just means our capacity to act. And that capacity to act starts with a sense of possibility. And that, to me, is rooted in this ecological way of seeing, in which we think like an ecosystem and see that change is the nature of life. And if that's true, then, as my friend in Germany, the physicist Hans-Peter Dürer says, in ecology, in fact, in biological systems, in the world as a whole, there are no parts, there are only participants. So that then we see the power that we have, that moment to moment we are affecting our environment, and then that opens us to a sense of possibility. And so I describe myself not as an optimist, because I can't see the future, but as a possibilist, because I know that the nature of life is change. And one of the things that most excites me is learning the new neuroscience findings that actually there are neurons in our brains that fire when we observe other people as if we were doing that act. So imagine the power that that gives us, one, to learn, and two, to affect others, because as people are listening to you, you are actually, you know, and you're setting up in their minds images and telling stories, there is actually part of their brain functioning as if they were engaged in that activity. So I think that this interconnected world that ecology teaches us, this is a huge breakthrough from the world of stasis and, you know, the power understood as either you have it or you don't, you know, a zero sum. If you have it, that means I don't, to power in a living democracy, meaning what we create together. And I think that is another core characteristic of a living democracy. We understand that we have to join with others to create power together to solve problems.
I love the way you organize your book, and so, you know, you take us through through this step of, you know, how do you create powerlessness by our own, you know, defeating narratives, right? And then you
right.
describe the relationship of power, this, you know, ubiquitous power that develops as people act, you know, and interact with one another. But also you talk about the art of democracy. You talk about the cycle of hope, and you really exemplify the way in which we as citizens are agents of our own actions. One of the key questions that we face today is that of economic inequality. We look mm-hmm. worldwide and we see that 2/3 of the world population are living below poverty. We know that every minute 3 children die of hunger. You know, and so when faced with this, most people just get really afraid. You know, it's just getting worse. So they seem to think they're not acting. They're just being neutral. But as my friend says,
right,
when you're being
can't be neutral, right?
Exactly. You're just on the side of power. So
right.
if you could maybe talk a little bit about some of the suggestions to make of how we make entry into these issues and how mm-hmm. our actions impact the alternatives that can be brought forward.
Well, first of all, we need buddies because we are so socially embedded, right? I mean, this is our great strength and it's our Achilles heel. In other words, because we're so connected to one another, we evolve that way to need the approval of others. It's really hard to break away from the dominant direction, which is taking us right over Victoria Falls, is like the way I like to think of it. You know, we're back there on the savannah, but we're headed in the wrong direction. So buddies are essential, that we find people who are equally desirous of waking up and finding their power and stopping the depression, because, you know, depression is the global pandemic. Today in the world, there are 50% more suicides than homicides because we evolved to be powerful. So I think finding buddies is critical. And in fact, in my Institute, Small Planet Institute, we're hoping to help people find groups who would like to go into the approach we take in getting a grip together. So if anybody's interested in that, they can email us at info@smallplanet.org and get together with others and find people in your community that are really want to break free of the powerlessness spiral. And recognizing the buddies are so important, I want to tell you that one of my favorite new studies I ran across at University of Virginia, where they took 2 groups of students and set them at the foot of a hill with a heavy backpack on all of their backs, and the only difference in the 2 groups was that one had a friend by their side, each person, and the others didn't. And then the experimenter said, okay, how steep is that hill in front of you? And the people who had the buddy by their side judged that hill to be significantly less steep, less daunting. And the longer they'd known that person, the more effect it had. And so, you know, I think the first step is not to feel too much alone in this, even though the dominant media can make us feel so alone. And that's why programs like yours, and I say to everybody I know, you know, make a commitment to yourself to at least once a week read a story, watch a story about possibility, about regular people who are seizing the power and developing the power themselves. And that's what keeps me going. I mean, I'm just amazed at what people don't know that's going on that's so positive. My latest thrill is telling people that the UN Environmental Program, for example, set the goal of 1 billion trees worldwide planted each year starting in 2007. And they, you know what? They have to keep upping their goal because they're now at 10 billion trees, more than. And it's only 3 years into this. And I thought, you know, you have a little faith here, you know, I thought that, oh, 1 billion is too ambitious. So my point is that to believe in possibility, we have to, since we are social creatures, we take in, you know, what we observe, that to actively bring in stories from programs like yours, Yes Magazine, for example, which you can find and subscribe to, make that commitment to bring in that diet, not just the healthy food diet, but the healthy media diet.
I guess sometimes fear tends to stop people from seeing alternatives. You know, how do we then make those connections? Because in your website, Small Planet Institute, you know, the only choice we have is whether or not we want to change the world. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, if we really do think like an ecosystem, and you think that in nature, in wider nature, of course, we are nature, you know, everything is created by the context in which it is in and shaped, you know, a plant thrives or not depending on what situation it's in, what is the soil like, does it have access to the sunlight, etc. And so everything is shaped by everything around it. And that's what I mean when by saying the only choice we don't have is whether to change the world. Because every expression on our face affects the people around us. We walk into a supermarket, and if we purchase food that has been grown by spraying pesticides, we are saying, we're sending back signals, and we're saying, yes, more poisoning of pesticides. And already, you know, farm workers, at least in the U.S., their life expectancy is you know, around 50 years. So it's drastically less than the rest of the population, and part of that is exposure to pesticides. And, you know, we each have pesticides in our system with untold harm to us. So the point is that every choice we make is sending out signals, both directly by people observing us. I mean, we can think of so many examples of inspiration that we get from others saying, oh, I didn't know that was possible. Like, I was just at a wonderful gathering where I met a fellow who was not a mechanic, who was probably no more than 20 years old, who just built his own electric car for $1,300, including the price of a car. And so I said, well, how did you do that? He said, I went to the library, and he got a book. So just meeting him, I started telling other people, and who knows, you know, what other, my partner is very handy, and his eyes lit up. Oh, maybe I could do that. You know, in other words, I mean, this is such a, in one way, tiny, trivial example of how we affect others, but every act, whether it's a purchase, whether it's, you know, as I say, the way we treat one another, do we accelerate fear when we're out and about in our daily lives? Do we engage and look in people's eyes? And if we don't, then we are accelerating the fear cycle that keeps people from action, just in subtle ways. So we have enormous power. And, of course, over, you know, our children who model themselves on us, what we tolerate from others in the workplace in terms of do we stand up for ourselves and our own dignity. So there's no end to the possibility. I think the question is, finding that curiosity in ourselves that once a famous historian, Theodore Zeldin, wrote that curiosity is the greatest antidote to fear. So if we live our lives driven by what we're curious about, then we can keep walking with that fear of the unknown and of rejection and live the life we want to live, which I think most of us want to live a really meaningful life, where we get to the end and we say, wow, you know, I just kept going and I kept learning and I did my very best, right?
And that's so beautiful. You're so right. And, you know, one of the best ways to overcome fear, as you point out, is knowledge, information. So tell our audience, yes, how they can access your book, Get in a Grip 2, Clarity, Creativity, and Courage for the World We Really Want.
Oh, well, hopefully any bookstore would have it. You certainly can order it on Amazon. And as I said, if you're taken by the ideas in this book, and let me underscore that it's not a long book, and it's organized into short chapters that I think groups can, and many have, you know, gotten into discussion about it, because it's really something I think that combines the psychological, the personal, shall we say, with the larger world. So if you please email us at info@smallplanet.org if you'd like us to help you find other people who would like to discuss the book with you. They're also downloadable on our website, smallplanet.org, the spirals that open and close the book so you can get a sense of the ideas in the book. And if you're interested in the arts of democracy I mentioned, such as creative conflict, for example, you can download from our website something called Doing Democracy, 10 Practical Arts, which is a 40-page booklet. So we are very easy to find and very eager to interact with people, because this book, Getting a Grip, is something I'm going to keep reprinting throughout the rest of my life and updating. So I need people to engage with me. What worked about it? What was moving? And what stories can I add from their own experience?
That's wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us. As I mentioned in my introduction, Frances Moore Lappe is well known worldwide. She's been called the Hope Warrior, and I think a very well-deserved name. And the book is just fantastic. Thank you so much for spending time with us.
Oh, you're so kind, and I'm so glad you're doing what you're doing. Such important work. So thank you. Thank you for what you do.
Thank you. Take care.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We have come to the end of our program. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program available to campus and community radios. Please visit our website, www.latinwavesmedia.com, to hear previous shows, connect to our media projects, and access other resources, or to support our efforts by making a safe PayPal contribution. I am Sylvia Richardson. Thanks for listening.